This episode of The Disciplined Investor is brought to you by Masterworks. Visit masterworks.io for more information.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The presidential race has been called. The Biden-Harris ticket has it. Amazing news. A vaccine announcement with over 90% efficacy. Small caps rage higher on the news. Leisure stocks, airlines, cruise lines, banks all rise. Happy days, maybe here again. And we have listeners' questions answered. All this and much more on episode number 688 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And now that we have some time to digest the election and the outcome, well, here we are. We do a quick introduction and we'll get right into it today. My name is Andrew Horowitz. I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the co-host of DH Unplugged, which we do every Tuesday night on live version and recorded. You can listen to that over on dhunplugged.com or go to your favorite podcasting app, of course, and grab that. Myself and John C. Dvorak are yammering up, talking about all sorts of areas around the markets, finance, et cetera. Now, here, what we do here on the Disciplined Investor Show, for the most part, is talk about finance, money, investments. We talk about your financial future, financial security, and we answer your questions, those really important issues that are relevant and timely each and every week. Now, I guess we have to say we live in interesting times. I'm sure that you'll agree with that. I mean, how can you not agree with that? Now, you may hate the times we live in, you may love the times that we live in, but my goodness, they are interesting. There's no two ways about that. And here we are, almost 10 months into this whole pandemic, and in record time, we see that we have a vaccine candidate that has shown incredible promise. I mean, vaccines take years to create. And many of them, the majority of them fail. They just can't get to what it is. And we've been fighting certain things for years now without any ability to combat them. And now we see that Pfizer and BioNTech have come up with a drug that has over 90% efficacy. Amazing. I mean, remarkable. The words that could describe how fast they've come up with this and the potential for them being so beneficial to fight this terrible pandemic is remarkable. We are talking what was hoped to be somewhere in the 40 to 50% effectiveness for a vaccine is now over 90%. And the speed of what this was done at. I mean, nobody thought that we were going to see it so fast. Yeah, there was some talk about possibly by the election, by the end of the year. Now, the question still remains, when are we going to get this out there? But to have a 90% level of effectiveness on the virus, I mean, in a way, we're kind of talking about the potential for quick eradication if everything lines up well. I mean, there's a lot of hurdles, a lot of things that have to happen. We have logistics. We have the how it actually has to be stored at such a extremely cold level, and then how is it supplied, and how many can be made at any given point. Of course, how many people will take the vaccine because of concerns over how quickly it was done. But this really put a fire under stocks, and in particular, it really turned the dial significantly from what was working to what was not working and reversed those dramatically. And the good news, we still have a lot of other companies that are still working on this. I mean, in Russia, they talked about a 90% efficacy on their Sputnik vaccine. It could be good if that happens. And we have multiple companies that are still working on a very similar process to what Pfizer is doing. And that could mean that there is multiple variants of this particular vaccine. I mean, no one could be sad about this. No one could be upset about this. I don't care what you're thinking. The fact is, to get back to normality, there's no words that can be put on this. So again, a great deal of promise, in particular for the worst hit areas in the economy, to open up again with a vengeance here, with the opportunity to have not only do we have much better overall treatments, and now we may have some kind of vaccine. But again, we have to go through the whole approval process, logistics issues, as I was mentioning, production, distribution. But I am sure that we will be able to swiftly deal with all that. Now, I want to take you back to Monday, because what was going on was pretty amazing last week. Remember, we talked about the week before was one of the worst weeks overall for markets since, I don't know, March or so. Some, you know, going back a couple of weeks, and it was dropping into the election, then a couple of days up, and then the election happened last week. And we saw that markets drove higher, and a lot of people are wondering, well, what's the story here? What's going on? And I want to take you back to after we saw that, at least from what it appears to be, and it's probably going to be dragged out for some time, no matter what is said and done. But once we saw that Biden and Harris got the quote unquote the verification of enough votes to win this whole thing, there was a significant bid under markets. Now, on Monday, we came in that, yeah, over the weekend, there was some good news about the fact that we got to the end of the election cycle, and more outlets were saying that there was a winner and everybody's happy and on the Democrat side and miserable on the other side, but yet we're kind of getting to the end of this, right? So there was some relief going on. We talked about this relief rally potential some time ago. And it was a lot stronger than I had anticipated. But one of the things that happened was that there was the acknowledgement of the potential for a split government. We'll get to that in a second. But in the pre-market on Monday, stocks were starting to ramp higher and all that. And then this announcement came out, I don't know, about 7 a.m. or something like that. And it was instantaneous, the incredible short squeeze that happened and the buying activity that went in. So we have the combination of the election being over and a particular setup with regard to government, right? We're going to have split government. That was kind of making people excited in terms of, you know, the fact that we don't have some problems that may be there that we thought were going to be there if a blue wave broke out, et cetera, in terms of markets. And it broke higher. Futures on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, small caps rallied, and the biggest beneficiaries of all this were the casinos and cruise lines, banks, movie theaters, energy companies were really ramping. Small caps, value-oriented investments. I mean, this was a total 180 of what was working and what wasn't working, flipping the script. And what was really interesting was the stay-at-home names like Zoom Media and e-learning companies, eDocs and Peloton and Netflix, Clorox, were not doing as well. The NASDAQ 100 stocks were up a bit, and then they kind of started coming back and pairing those losses on Monday, especially when you compare them to the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the small caps. Now, in fact, there were moments during the day when the market opened on Monday that the NASDAQ went negative when you have a 4.5% upside of the Dow Jones and 3.5% for the S&P 500, 6.5% up for the small caps. We had some back and forth, massive rotation that was going on. That's really what was happening. I mean, early going that morning, I wrote down some notes. Planet Fitness was halted as it ramped higher. Etsy was halted as it crashed lower. Remember, Etsy did really well on their mask selling and their kind of whole stay-at-home alternative gig economy, and that's what was happening. So what we saw was this rotation that we were talking about for some time and probably expected once there was better news on the direction of the pandemic. And even though There is no better news on the direction of the pandemic, right? There's nothing alike here. We see higher cases in the U.S., record numbers around the world. We see that Europe is closing down. New Jersey is starting to close down dining again. And we're seeing El Paso shut down for a few weeks. Not really a lot to like there, but the fact that there may be an effective vaccine did the trick on top of the situation with the election. And we have to stop for a moment. A lot of people are asking the question, well, before this vaccine news, why were markets going up anyway? What was the story there? I mean, the whole idea that we were going to have Biden win was supposed to take markets down, right? Well, that's half the story. The other part of the story was that there was a whole notion that there was going to be this Democratic takeover of Congress, both sides, and the House and the Senate, and we're going to have Biden as the president, therefore being able to really push policy initiatives very strongly through. And what ended up happening so far, as we're sitting here, we don't really know. I mean, I think it's going to take a couple of weeks till everything flushes out, till its absolute finality, is that if Biden won the election, but yet we have a split Congress and the Republicans still had the majority or at least a heavy influence on the Senate, therefore we are going to have problems getting through some of the things like higher taxes. And that was one of the baseline issues that was really concerning to equity investors. If, in fact, capital gains taxes were higher, if, in fact, there was a rise in the tax rate for corporations, all these things were really swirling around everybody's head and freaking everybody out, like, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen to profitability and earnings? And this was going to be a big problem. And what ended up happening, at least from what we could see, is, well, this divided government, which won't really allow some of the major issues probably to go through, was really very exciting for equity investors. So that's kind of what was getting things going. Now, we have to look at also what's going on behind the scenes with regard to how a lot of these other issues may play out. For example, now that we have the vaccine news, what about stimulus? Remember, the two major things that were really driving markets one way or the other recently, aside from elections, was what and how much, when and where are we going to get the stimulus? Number one. Number two, what about the spread of this virus? What about the direction of the pandemic? Those were the two major issues, and they were kind of, I would say, hand in hand working together. The more we had the potential for the continuation of an outbreak, shutdowns, slowdowns, the more potential we have for stimulus. The more, unfortunately, people were in need, I mean, this says it all, right, is the more that we would fill that need with stimulus. And the two sides couldn't get together on this. But now we have a question. If, in fact, it seems that we are in the end game for this whole vaccine development and for the pandemic, will we have a need for as much stimulus as was originally being discussed? The Republicans are now looking to offer a skinny deal. And that would make sense. Even before we had the whole vaccine discussion, it would make sense to be very targeted. And we've mentioned this. So the question then remains, is the big deal done? Is it just off the table? Especially if there is a vaccine. I mean, kind of hopes for a big deal is a little bit faded from where we were a few months ago, don't you think? It's going to be interesting to see just what will be accepted by both sides at this juncture. If there is a belief that, you know what, if we really flood the markets with too much stimulus here and we have a vaccine and everybody gets back to work, will we really overheat this economy to a level that is just unsustainable? Because we know that the Fed is still in play. And the dollar was dropping right before the news on this, right before the news on the election. The dollar was dropping and then ramped higher. Gold and silver came off on the news. Perhaps the move was a bit exaggerated, as we know that the printing presses are still in play with the Fed. We know that is not stopping anytime soon. But some of the market risk was kind of taken out of the big balloon as the vaccine development and the election being over is kind of assumed to be reduced with all this. And this is exactly what we were discussing last week, the idea that we have to make adjustments when there's new data and significant data that changes the outlook. And the real question we really need to focus in on, I think, right now is how much of the change will hold? And will this be the answer to all of the pandemic woes? Because we still know that a lot of banks have some really bad debt on hand, and we see that, you know, possibly the bankruptcies, evictions, and mortgage moratoriums, all that that's been going on, there's a piper that has to be paid in the end of all this. So right now what we're having is this news flow that's kind of in your face. And we get these, as we call it, face-ripping rallies and jaw-dropping drops that are probably going to be here for a while until we can get some notion of exactly how all these moving parts are going to play together. We've seen exaggerated money moves in terms of currencies and commodities, equities, bonds. We saw that the 10-year ticked above 0.9 or 90 basis points on Monday with that news. And kind of, you know, we're seeing that bonds are starting to kind of shape up and shake out, and the longer ones are getting hit a little bit harder. And even though the Fed has promised and committed to keeping those rates low, it may be out of their hands for a little while. So some things that we're really focusing on and looking at just to kind of give you a little bit of reflection about what happened earlier this week. Now, as you know, we have the weekly pop-up Q&A webinar that we do every Monday, answering your questions live. It's easy to register if you have anything that you want to talk about. It is over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Top right, just click on the registration. You'll get right in there. There's no cost. It's easy. It just gives you reminders of when the webinar, and gives you the key and the access point to get in. So I want to mention that. So I thought we'd dedicate this show to answer some of your questions that maybe, you know, you haven't been at that Q&A webinar, and just kind of talk about that. And I have a pile of them right here we're going to go through. But before we do that, I want to talk about Masterworks. Because did you know that, this is amazing, about 1% of day traders actually turn a profit? You know, obviously there's some people that work on the area of day trading and they kind of get into it and then just say, forget it, because you know what? It's hard work. So why are so many people mistakenly kind of just going out there and buying a stock from the TV and think that's serious investing? Because you can't control the markets. We know that. We talk about that all the time. But you can control your risks. So the question is, how do billionaire investors control their risk? Well, one of the ways is they invest in blue chip art. Now, that sounds kind of unusual to you. You're not alone, okay? But the ultra wealthy have been investing in art for centuries. From 2000 to 2018, the numbers show that art outperformed the S&P by 180%. And just a few years ago, a single work of art sold for $450 million. Can you imagine that? Now, being able to invest in the very same paintings as millionaires and billionaires at a fraction of the cost is something that's available. Masterworks.io. It's an exclusive platform that makes it easy as trading stocks online. And the best part? You don't need to know anything about art, because the experts at Masterworks will create a custom portfolio to meet your investment needs. With Masterworks.io, you don't have to choose between big risks and big returns. So what you could do is, you could sign up today. What you do is go over to Masterworks.io, use the promo code TDI, and you can skip the 25,000-person waiting list that's trying to get first dibs on all this. Again, that's Masterworks.io, promo code TDI. See important information at Masterworks.io/disclaimer. So as I had promised, we have a good amount of listener questions that I thought we would spend some time answering. And you wrote them in, you sent them off, and let's get to some of those right now. Some of the questions I answered directly, but I thought that many of the ones that we're going to be discussing today probably were on the minds of a lot of people because it was areas that I really never thought about talking about right now. So the first one comes in from Henry. And Henry writes, he says, Dear Mr. Horowitz, I'm a 16-year-old who is interested in learning how to invest and save well for retirement. First of all, let's just stop right there. Henry, 16 years old, listening to a financial podcast, interested in his retirement. No kidding. I mean, it takes some people to their 40s and 50s to start thinking about retirement. So kudos to you for starting this early. He continues on and says, I started an UGMA Roth IRA through Vanguard this past winter. I promptly invested $1,000 in a target rate fund through Vanguard. And after recently discovering your awesome podcast, I am interested in what you would recommend for investments and strategy. Thanks for the great podcast and resources from Henry. So, you know, you're on the right track in terms of if you're thinking about long-term investing, those are what those target funds do. Now, usually I don't necessarily recommend a target-based fund if you have other alternatives available because sometimes they're more expensive than some of the alternatives. Sometimes what happens is that you're just getting kind of this, whatever they're deciding to do, you don't really have a lot of control over understanding what is in the underlying investments and maybe not exactly what you want to invest in. However, with the target date fund that you're looking at, which is way out in the future, most of the investments in the underlying fund are going to be in equities. Probably where you want to be as you have, let's calculate this, I don't know, 50 years until sometime in the future when you're going to retire. Now, a lot of things are going to happen over that time period, right? Markets are going to cycle up and down. They're going to move from left to right, up and down, forward and backward. I think that what you want to try to start doing is look into areas around the world, probably start peppering in some ETFs, low-cost alternatives. You can invest in things like healthcare or technology ETFs in the U.S. You could look at international. We talked about how I like some of the international exposure, like emerging markets for the long haul. And I think you continue doing that as you get money available. You continue to broaden out your portfolio with domestic large cap, small cap, mid cap, international, emerging markets, and developed international. So you kind of get a well-balanced positioning overall. Until such time that it gets to be too heavy in one particular area and you may want to start refining. But as you're building your portfolio, I think you're right on with getting this kind of, we'll call it, diversified approach as you did through your target date fund, but you may be able to do so a little bit cheaper by utilizing ETFs on your own. You could probably look for the ETFs that have the largest holdings, and you just, you know, you could find out the ones that have the greatest volume, the largest traded. Ask the trading desk of where you're working with, hey, what's the most, you know, the most popular ETFs in emerging markets? What's the most popular ETFs in let's say in the U.S. in terms of large cap or tech or healthcare, gold or, you know, commodities. Those questions could probably get you right where you want to be. So great question from Henry. I think starting out the process is the biggest hurdle, and you did that. So really, that's awesome. It's just nothing better and nothing makes me happier than to see someone who is getting involved at such a young age to make sure that your future is secure. That's what it's all about. So great going. Our next question comes in from Jason. He said, this is from about a couple of weeks back. He said, most recently, these precious metals have been getting crushed. I keep reading that the strong dollar is to blame. Can you explain the relationship between metals like gold and silver and the dollar? Do you think there is a correction at play also, or is the strong dollar solely to blame for the downturn? So this could be a discussion anytime, any place, because we'll see these kinds of situations start to play out where the favoring of investors are leaning towards, let's say, a risk-on trade into equities, a risk-off trade into bonds, into metals, into precious metals. And when we see that, we have to recognize that, is this something that is a temporary circumstance that maybe is a 1 day, 5 day, 2 week, 2 month situation? Or is it the continuation of a directional move, but inside of there, there is some corrective action happening? Now, we're never going to see, aside from a few stocks, anything go straight up. There's going to be bumps along the way. Now, one of the things we do know is we have been seeing, generally speaking, over the last several months, that the dollar has been coming down, and it spikes up a little bit, then comes back down. And the direction, generally speaking, of the dollar has been trending lower. Until that trend is broken and we see a substantial turnaround to that trade, there could be some potential problems here and there for gold. If we continue to see that the risk on trade favors risk assets, and maybe the central bank starts really heating up and increasing interest rates, and the dollar maybe, I don't know, on another hand, starts to increase as well, we could see gold, silver, precious metals, you know, have some problems. But I still think in a world where we are so involved with central banks and low interest rates, and with stimulus hitting as it has and how it's going to be probably over the next couple of years to combat all the problems that were brought forth due to the pandemic, even if there is the vaccine that we've been talking about, I still think there is an opportunity to keep gold and silver inside of a portfolio for diversification. You can go back in time, and there have been these periods where it just hasn't worked, where gold and silver just are not playing. And then all of a sudden, there's a desire. It could be because of external circumstances that are pressing down on investor confidence. It could be because of a move in a currency against the grain, and all of a sudden the precious metals start picking up. It could be simply that central banks are buying or selling a significant amount of that particular metal. So I want you to look at this and draw it out on a long-term chart and see what that trend is showing you. So we will see corrections from time to time, but we will also see the opportunity to continue in a trend that has been rooted in a long-term structure. So what I'm asking you to do is look at a long-term chart, a weekly chart, monthly chart, a daily chart, And make a decision for yourself if that line is consistent with a longer-term move that looks positive in that direction. And then lay down some levels that says, you know what, if we get below this particular support point, that's when I'm going to throw in the towel or cut my position. Or if I think it's just temporary, buy on the dip. Good question. Really good question. All right, what do we got next? Brad. Brad comes in. A little bit long. Let's see what Brad says. Hey, Andrew, I'm a podcast subscriber, a former Floridian now living in L.A., and I absolutely love the show and look forward to listening to it every week. Thank you. I have a question. Can't seem to get an answer, and I can't find anyone writing or podcasting about it, even though it seems it's kind of staring me in the face. I understand everything you're talking about, how the Fed is trying to create inflation to meet the 2% threshold. But inevitably, high inflation would lead to higher interest rates. Why would they want to do that if higher interest rates would mean that the cost of services and cost of servicing the trillions of government the government has in debt would skyrocket? And not only for our government, but for all the governments in personal debt. It seems that they're pushing for something that will sow the seeds for our own destruction with debt service costs that will go through the roof. What am I missing? Maybe there's a topic worth mentioning on the podcast. Thanks and keep up the great work. Actually says amazing work. Thanks and keep up the amazing work. Brad, so where do I start with this? Where do we start with this? Let's break it down a little bit. So the Fed is keeping inflation kind of anchored. Their expectations for inflation kind of anchored right now, but yet they're keeping yields low. We see the fiscal stimulus is coming in and maybe a little bit too much to keep inflation tamped down. However, we have record debts. That's what you're saying, is record debts being put forth by companies and sovereigns, et cetera. So therefore, if in fact we get a higher level of inflation, which is the expectation, hopes, and desire of the Fed, won't that actually push up yields? And if we push up yields, doesn't that cause a big problem to those people that have to pay the service on the debt? And the answer to all of that is an invariable yes. It's a problem. This is why the Fed is walking a tightrope right now. The problem is that they want something to happen, but not too much. They want to keep rates low because of the outstanding debt that was just put on, the $4-plus trillion that was added to their book, right, added to their assets over the last several months, on top of the $4 trillion or so they already had. That also is talking squarely into government debt. Government debt goes up. The interest rate that is being issued on government debt goes up. That means that governments, when they issue the debt, will have to pay that much more, and that will go against the potential for growth. Because when you have higher debt costs, well, it stymies growth. You have to pay those debt costs. So it's a very weird circumstance. It's almost to a point of, let's call it a conundrum. They want to keep rates low. They want inflation to go higher, but they don't want it too high, much higher. They're willing to keep their interest rates low. That's why they started talking about this inflation averaging, because they realized that if, in fact, we start to see growth and inflation due to the fiscal stimulus that's being poured on by not only our governments, but governments around the world into the economies, a direct feed of money, and therefore that would create a significant amount of price increase due to a supply-demand. If demand comes back due to, like, the vaccine we've talked about, or just simply the fact that low-cost money, lots of money in the system, creates excessive amounts of demand, well then, hey, they would be forced under normal circumstances to start raising interest rates. So right along what you're talking about, Brad. No question about that. However, we made it very clear that the reason they signaled for this inflation averaging is they do not want to raise rates no matter what happens in the near term. If we start seeing inflation and it starts to pick up substantially in this environment, what's going to happen is they're going to say, you know what, we're not worrying about that now, because we're going to look at the average inflation over the last year or so, 2 years, and because we were sub-level that we wanted to attain during that period, what's happening now is we're going to hold it for that much longer, which could theoretically yield a much higher level inflation in the future. But their hope is that what they've seen before over the last 10 years, even in the incredibly low interest rate environment, is going to continue, that they are going to stay at or near that 2% level, up or on the upside or downside, give or take a couple of little bits of basis points here or there, and therefore not be forced to raise interest rates too quickly. Now, this could all backfire in their face severely, and I think we all recognize that. But I don't think that's really going to happen. If you think about all that went on back in the financial crisis, and the banks going under and real estate going under and all that went on there, the overbuilding and then the crash and the pickup, the markets picked back up, inflation kind of picking up, and what did we end up doing? One time that we were thinking about raising interest rates, they had a turnaround on a dime and start dropping it. This is even before there was anything that we thought of and before the word COVID came into our vocabulary. So it's a conundrum. It's a problem. But there's a reality here that long-term, I can't imagine interest rates staying as low as they are. And this is why we've been advising and recommending and implementing a very different kind of fixed income portfolio inside of our strategies. Now, if you have any fixed income in your portfolio, this is something you really need to pay attention to, because you got to wonder, have I been lucky so far? Do you feel lucky? Have I been lucky? Have I been just going with the flow here and things are playing well into what I've been doing? But is there a train wreck on the other side when it comes to my fixed income component? And am I properly set up? Do I have the right duration? Do I have the right maturity? That's exactly what we really spend a lot of time on in our fixed income portfolios, giving you that optimal side of things, because we don't want to get into a situation where we're going to be riding along in that caboose on that train. That all of a sudden we realize that, boy, that was ugly. So bonds are an issue you really need to focus on right now. If you have that in your portfolio, really, you need to talk to somebody and that can really analyze what's happening in there. And then also recognize that what Brad's talking about, this conundrum about inflation, as well as all the debt we have outstanding and the potential for it coming back and biting us in the caboose, if you will. Well, that's something there. All right, next question up. Thank you, by the way, Brad. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Next question is from James. He says, ITM citizen in the morning, do you have a DH Unplugged or TDI episode where you talk in detail about how to pay taxes on investments? I would like to try to make some money, quote, unquote, playing the stock market, but I'm very concerned on how to keep proper records on all the money earned and lost and how to work with both a tax preparer and my broker. If you haven't made a segment on what you need to know about paying taxes before you invest, for example, don't let it happen to you, please do so for me. Thank you. So James, basically, here's the deal. Let's make it very easy. Let's just say that you're going to trade one stock one time for a year. You buy stock XYZ for a dollar. You buy 100 shares. You sell it for $2. You sell the 100 shares. You made a dollar a share or $100 profit. It was done within a short-term capital gain period, less than 12 months, let's say. You did it one day. It happened. Well, the good news is that your broker will provide you at the end of the year a 1099 that will show you all of your gains and losses. They're required to do so. So you do not have to necessarily keep all the records for taxes for the end of the year. But let's say this gets a little bit more complicated than one trade, one time per year. Start trading a lot. Larger shares, smaller shares, holding, selling, buying, all that, right? Well, again, they will provide at the end of the year your cost basis, amount of proceeds, how much your gain or loss was, and the net. You hand that over to your tax preparer. They can handle it. But what you want to do is throughout the year, just keep track of where your buys and sells are and what your cost basis. Again, something you can get from your broker throughout the year. Good brokers, they'll do this for you. And know where you are. Assume that every single trade you make, you win. Well, you're going to have to pay taxes. It's going to add into your ordinary income if the short-term gains, you don't hold them for a long period of time, you know, over a year. And if you do hold them over a year, there's a reduced level of capital gains tax. But let's assume you're trading, as you talk about here. You need to keep on top of that. So all of a sudden, by the end of the year, if you have a $35,000 gain on all of your trades that you made and you didn't put any taxes aside in your estimates, at the end of the year, you don't get this 1040 that you put in. All of a sudden, it's like, yes, please pay an extra $10,000 because you didn't properly plan throughout the year by utilizing the estimated tax process. Now, you'll never know exactly as you're trading what is the right amount to put into taxes or not, but you can get kind of close at least. So keep track of it by looking at your broker. Make sure you ask your broker, can I get a year-to-date breakdown of what my capital gains and losses are? Just do a simple spreadsheet for yourself, an Excel spreadsheet. When you buy something, when you sell something, what was the gain or loss? And then just keep track of it throughout the year. But the good news is that it's all going to be able to be reported very easily by your broker for your tax preparer and have all that consolidated for you for the end of the year. Good question. This question comes in from Peter. Peter says, on a recent episode, Linda Rashke mentioned Market Profile several times, implying that she knew that Andrew uses it. What platform or tools do you use to leverage Market Profile? I haven't found a dynamic way to apply it to my charts. It is very inconsistent and non-existent across platforms, unlike most other indicators. So the the core market profile, for those of you that don't know what we're talking about here, is this concept of utilizing a date range on a chart, whatever chart that is, let's say a daily chart of a stock, and combining, instead of volume across the bottom in a very one-dimensional view, it combines not only the volume, but the price paid per tick. So every single time a stock is bought, it says, okay, well, at that price, how many shares were bought and adds it all together and gives you a kind of a more of a two-dimensional view of price and volume and puts it on a chart in a certain time range and says, okay, during this time range, this is where it is. This is the range. This is what how much was bought. So therefore, if the multitude of the price that was being bought on volume was at, let's say, 45, you would see a thicker part of the chart being in that range of $45 and probably less at, let's say, 30 and more at, less at 48. But it would kind of block up and show you where that is in a chart. A lot of the market profiles that are out there are very simplistic. They just look at the entire range of your chart. It could be like a year or 2 years, and just put it to the right-hand side and kind of put a couple of bars that span out horizontally. So one of the things that we did actually, we use in our office because we built this, is something on the TradeStation trading app platform or the TradeStation platform through the trading app store. And it's called the purest of pure market profile is called the Radar. That's what we call it. There's also something called the Commander Series. If you go over, you just look this up, type this into Google, type in TradeStation trigger charts, and it will show you all the different indicators that we built for TradeStation. These are for pay. Some are free, but all of them have a 10-day free trial. Check them out, and you'll find that our radar is applied dynamically for you. That's the market profile. In addition to that, we went one step further. We said, okay, let's get the real core of what's important inside any particular market profile and just stick that right on a chart. Where's that resistance? Where's that support? Where's that high volume node or where's that center line? Where's the kind of that important level of core where people are buying? Where are they really hitting this? And we just put three lines instead of 50 lines on the chart. Just three lines within a range. And we use an algorithm with a swing pattern to figure out, okay, we're only going to look at this section, this 20-day section on a daily chart of where the action really is. That's dynamic. So you go to TradeStation and check that out. Other than that, I haven't found any, and that's why I built this. I was as simple as that. So I think it works really well. You have to get used to how it looks. Color-coded makes it easy, but you can check it out there. Let's see here. This one is for over here. Okay. Our last question comes in from James. Oh, no, James, we did already. No, that's not it. I got to find the next one. Ah, this one's from Aaron. He said, can you please comment on the disparity between increasing auto production and sales? In other words, people distrusting the public transit and possible viral transmission and the lack of aggressive movement in the gasoline fund. The price is normally lower this time of year, and I usually buy it about this time. This was from, just a couple weeks back or a week back. I usually buy it in and about this time of year and sell it in May, but given the horrible energy producer stock prices and the fact that most of us buy gasoline-powered vehicles, the UGA and the oil producers' refineries are about to rise. So I think what you're asking me here is this. Why are we not seeing the gasoline fund kind of come down the way it should? And it has to do with a bit of a supply-demand. It has to do with the fact that, you know, obviously we're trying to keep supply down and OPEC is doing so, and you get the refiners and all that. I would tell you that you have to realize that I think that oil and gas are a wasting asset right now. I know that we saw a very significant bump in the price of oil and gas in the early part of this week due to the thought that, hey, you know what, we're back and everybody's going to get in the car and go and travel and do, and the airlines are going to be taking off and going and doing their thing, and we're going to see trains and planes and cruises and all this because we have a vaccine. I would be careful with some of the commodity-related ETFs. They don't always track the prices very well. And I would really encourage you to look at some of that if that's what you're doing and put them on a chart next to the actual commodity price and see if there's any divergence. See if the price actually is holding up as well as it should, considering the movement of what the underlying commodity is. Make sure that you are finding that the potential for variance in the pricing isn't something that is really because of the way that the commodities are structured, with backwardation, with the potential rolling of commodities futures, or whatever else may be the way they structure the actual ETF, the underlying investments, and how it may dislocate from the actual commodity itself. So that could be something that's going on as well. We saw that years ago in like natural gas, the natural gas fund. The oil funds had problems for years, and it could be happening this as well. I also think that, you know, there is a reality starting to set in that, you know, we're not sure what the demand is going to be long term, but prices have stabilized a bit. And remember, we have an excess of oil right now capacity compared to what the demand is. And that's why OPEC's been bringing down production. And we see that. But yet at the same time, the U.S. has an incredible amount of supply as well. And that may be making its way to the refiners, and they're just not necessarily changing the pricing at this point. There's a whole bunch of things that go inside oil, well beyond my pay grade, by the way, well beyond my pay grade. But something that I think you should look into, especially as you're investing in it, not in the direct commodity itself. I think that's something that really has to be explored and need to really figure out if that's getting a little bit wonky because of that. With that, I want to thank everyone who sent in their questions. We got a lot more, like I said, that I answered directly because they were a little bit more specific. But I thought a lot of these would be really helpful. Anytime you have any questions at all, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew. This is all about you. It's all about us. It's all about making sure that not only are hopefully entertaining you, but also bringing you good education about the area of finance and money. Listen, I've been doing this for decades, so I could probably impart something to you here and there. So with that, we're going to end the show, and I want to let you know that I really appreciate all that you do for me. I want to make sure that you know that we have the Monday Q&A pop-up webinars, DH Unplugged, and anything that you need from me, I'm here for. Just simply send your question or comment in, and please do me a favor, spread the word, tell your friends, tell your family, tell people who you love about the show, give them the link, share it out on Twitter. That's how we can make sure that we get the entire world as best as possible, financially fit and disciplined in their investment process. So long for this week, and I'll see you again soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.